Because the reality today is innovation in lending is coming from new entrants and challengers. New entrants and challengers fundamentally face a disadvantage around a high cost of funds. And that forces most people to operate in a largely unsecured space and at higher price points. If we want to break this dynamic, if we want more innovation in secured lending, if we want lower price points of unsecured lending, we need to find ways to open up the regulatory architecture to enable challengers to tap into a new cost of funds. I think until we have wider and deeper debt capital markets, this will remain a constraint to innovation, and that action needs to come from a regulatory and policy side.
Hi, wherever you're joining us, I hope you're doing well. Welcome to Startup Fridays, conversations with accomplished entrepreneurs and VC investors. I'm Hari Arakli, and in this episode, Sashank Rishyasringha and Gaurav Hinduja, co-founders of Axio, a buy now, pay later specialist in the fintech space in India, talk about how they are on the verge of becoming a profitably sustainable business. Axio today is serving close to 10 million customers, they say. And in this conversation, Gaurav and Sashank also talk about how, while a strong regulatory environment is critical in fintech, it can also become an enabler of innovation by finding ways to lower the cost of money for entrepreneurs with ideas for financial products that could benefit millions of consumers, which in turn can help India's economic growth. All right, Gaurav, Sashank, thank you so much for making time for this conversation. A lot has changed since you all started, and I think plenty of milestones and also ups and downs in the industry. From a more general audience's perspective, if you all want to give us a quick sense of how you became a buy now, pay later specialist, how you zeroed in on that briefly, and how you see that as your biggest opportunity and some of the things along the way that helped you get there, and then we'll go from there.
So Hari, I think let's start at the beginning, right? I think when Gaurav and I first moved back to India after having finished our MBAs at Stanford, we believed that there was a massive opportunity to address the retail credit gap. And when I say retail credit gap, I mean what a lot of people call the missing middle, right? Whether it's individuals or businesses, etc. And we also had a very strong conviction that technology was the only solution to this problem. And so our initial hypothesis was that of partnering with some of the large digital ecosystems that were starting to grow in the country, e-commerce, payments, travel, to partner with them to finance merchants and consumers on that platform. Now, this was long before fintech, embedded finance, India Stack were words in the industry. So I think in some ways we were a bit early. But to cut a long story short, where we finally found the right product, market, and risk fit was in offering embedded finance to consumers at checkout. Right? And this was a result of having spent years understanding both the digital ecosystems in the country, like Amazon, as well as the consumers and customers interacting with these ecosystems. So that's how the business as you see it today came together. And what we do today is essentially partner with large merchants and digital platforms. We embed credit at the point of sale to make purchases more affordable. This enables customers to spread purchases over multiple installments. It also helps increase conversion for merchants. We use that to build a relationship with the next frontier of customers who are digitally active but not well served by the banking system. And over time, we try and meet larger and larger credit needs of theirs through multiple products.
What's been interesting since obviously the last few years is just the scale at which we kind of operated, right? When we started, obviously, our aspiration was to serve a few thousand businesses or a few hundred thousand customers. But, you know, as I look back on this year, which is probably one of the best years for the company, we are almost at about 9.5-10 million customers today, of which about 4 million are pretty regularly using our services, right? And so the hypothesis that we always had, Shashank and I, is we wanted to come back and make an impact in terms of scale, right? That is actually starting to play out. Because while it is good to do, you know, 50,000, 100,000, 200,000 customers, when you're serving millions of customers on a monthly basis, 70% of whom don't even have a credit card to shop online, that's when you see that the impact you envisioned is really starting to play out.
So, sir, the past 12 months have been really sort of a game changer for your business. Tell us a bit more about that. Give us a sense of what happened and what are some of the things that you all did.
Yeah, you know, I would say more than the last 12 months, it's the last two or two and a half years coming out of COVID, right? I think COVID was in many ways a blessing, right? Because we obviously had to kind of look at the business, double down on areas that we felt really excited on, and really bet the house on something that we felt has really future potential. As we were entering COVID, we started really growing the buy now, pay later product with a few key partners such as Amazon, right? And then fast forward 12 to 18 months later, we realized that this business was actually very, very interesting in solving a consumer, massive consumer gap, right? And being able to give credit in real time while they're actually shopping online. And so that journey over the last two and a half years has now taken us to a point where we've grown revenue pretty significantly over the last 2-3 years. We have now become profitable as a business, at least in the last couple of quarters of this year. And finally, like I said, we are now operating at scale. And we have, most importantly, this being a lending business, I think we have become quite good at understanding risk and collections, right? Ultimately, that is at the heart of what this business is, right? It took us a while to learn, and COVID accelerated that learnings in terms of how do you manage risk, how do you manage collections, how do you manage cycles in this industry, which happen every, let's say, 12, 18, 24 months. And I think that muscle is something that has really developed over the last 2-3 years. And I think that effort of the last 2-3 years is why we are seeing this year the way we are seeing it and play out in terms of some of our best numbers we've ever seen.
You know, Hari, for better or worse, I think we've been early to a bunch of things, and that's shaped our journey. You know, a lot of the talk today in the industry is about sustainability, managing through disruption, managing through volatility. We went through a period of volatility a few years ago, right, over 18 and 19. And we had a set of learnings from that period. To Gaurav's point, those learnings have powered, you know, a journey in the last 2 or 3 years that has been beyond our expectations, right? And I think today, having built a profitable, you know, BNPL-led consumer credit business is something that we are extremely proud of. And what has made this possible is having experienced those moments of volatility in the early days of this business.
In startup jargon today, even like the sort of aam aadmi also knows about product market fit. But you spoke about product market risk fit, and I would imagine it's more unique to the fintech and financial services sectors. And you also said you've gotten very good at figuring out creditworthiness. So I guess they're connected. Maybe give us a couple of examples of some of the specific things that you all learned and did that has brought you here.
Fair. So look, as you correctly said, right, product market fit in lending is kind of a given, right? The country needs credit. So you start off with product market fit. What's more important in our mind is product market risk fit. Because while it's an exciting opportunity, it's very easy to lose your shirt if you can't manage risk. The way we have thought, kind of our learnings around risk have fallen into two areas. One is selection and the second is collection. And I'll speak briefly about selection, right? Much of what we focus on today is around picking the right customers up front. And in our mind, right is not that you have a thick credit score and you've been servicing 5 loans. It means that you have the right intent to pay and you have an ability to pay that matches the product that we're giving you. So we spend a lot of our time, effort, and energy trying to get these two things right. And the reality also in underwriting is you don't know if you're doing it right until you've lived through a cycle. And as I said, for better or worse, probably better, we have now lived through not one but multiple cycles. We have done over 100 million loans. We have seen customers pay and not pay in all different kinds of weather in the economy. And that has fed a set of underwriting models, right, driven by machine learning, that today are operating, I would say, at, you know, probably the best that we've ever seen. Thanks to that, our NPS today are about 2%, in many cases even less, right, through a period of sustained growth. to go a little under the hood on selection, a couple of areas where we really focus, right? One, as I said, is around intent. And for us, intent is about understanding a 360-degree view of a customer, right? It's about seeing your financial discipline on even a small credit product, right? It could be a secure loan. It could be even, let's say, a few like repayments on a smaller ticket product that we give you to start off with. It's also around ensuring that you are who you say you are, right? There's a lot of talk about fraud in the industry. We've been able to keep that rate of fraud, you know, to literally bips today. The second big part, I would say, even more than intent, is ability. And ability is actually about not just assessing ability, but also giving the right size. And so one of the areas where we have deeply invested is income estimation. So trying to be able to predict within a few seconds at the point of sale, what is the likely income range of a customer, right? Using multiple surrogates to arrive at that. Then obligating whatever debt you may have to service over that income. Understanding at the end of the month, what's the margin, or what we call net disposable income, that you will have available to be able to service a loan. And then finally, ensuring that our product is designed to meet that, right? There's no point assessing the fact that you can service a 5,000 rupee EMI and then giving a larger product where you can overlever yourself. So once we assess ability to pay, we actually take a low and grow approach where we start customers off on bite-sized amounts of credit, sized to what their ability is. We watch their repayment behavior over time, and then we accordingly scale the size of the credit based on that. So it's a very gradual process, but that creates a much higher quality customer performance over time. Now that's selection.
Partnering with a company like Amazon also feeds into all of this, gives you scale, also gives you that first level of validation of your customers. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. And so you have, I guess, rich data on their existing transactions, which probably gives you a better sense of their creditworthiness. I mean, does that all?
I think more than the data is just a selection of people who come and use that platform, right? Obviously, platforms like an Amazon or a Make My Trip or a Policy Bazaar, right? Attracting customers are what I would call the right set of customers who are looking for credit at the point of checkout, right? So you know someone who, for example, who's buying health insurance, who's buying a holiday package, who's, let's say, buying a mobile phone, typically are the ones who, A, need the credit, but because they're shopping online, they're obviously a little more digitally savvy. And we kind of use, as Shashank said, the income estimation that we have along with bureau to estimate the income and the obligations of the customer. And I think those become very critical when it comes to kind of underwriting and selecting the customer. But as what Shashank was saying, right, selection is one piece. I think what really happens is also the collection side of it. Right now, you can get everything right while selecting the customer. You can get everything wrong. But what will make or break your NPS along with selection and underwriting is collection, right? And I think a lot of fintechs and NBFCs typically shy away from calling this a strength, right? For us, we believe this is at our core a fundamental strength of the business, because over the last 2-3 years, we have built all the tech in-house for collections, right? So we do automated collections. We use like chatbots, voice bots that make it much easier for a customer to kind of pay back. We use a lot of messaging. We have callers as well as we have feet on street. So we don't shy away from any and every method of collection. Obviously, everything that's permitted by the RBI. And more importantly, we have all these people in-house. We don't outsource collections to any agency, to any collection shop, etc. Right? So we have built the capabilities of the tech and we have built the capabilities of people management to be able to make sure you get the money back. Right? This is a cliche. Everybody says easy to lend, but it's hard to get the money back. What we have learned is really how important it is to when you reach the customer, how you reach the customer, and how do you kind of empathetically kind of ask them for the money back, right? It's not about just going and knocking the door all the time. You have to understand their problems, but make sure that you are able to manage to a certain number as well.
With this backdrop, can you also talk about changes in the industry over the years? And you mentioned earlier on 18-19, you saw a lot of volatility. Some of that, I would imagine, was also about figuring out your own business first. So can you talk about what's happening in the industry today?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's become very evident that regulation is ultra, ultra critical in this industry, right? I think over the last few years, if you are trying to operate along the fringes of regulation for the sake of innovation, all of that has been stopped, right? We, from day one, fundamentally believe that regulation and innovation are not opposed to each other, right? You have to be able to innovate within the bounds of regulation, which is what we have always been doing, whether it comes to kind of having the right regulated license, whether it comes to kind of KYC, how do you build customer journeys around, you know, things like disclosures, etc., right? So I think given everything that we've seen in the last year or two, I think what has happened and what is happening is the best thing that could happen for this industry in terms of making sure every small player or every large player is very, very well regulated, right? And I think we are only going to see more and more of this, as we've already seen in the last year. I think that's one clear kind of area where all fintechs and let's say even NBFCs are starting to invest heavily on, right? I think the second thing that we are seeing in the industry is that, you know, for a while it seemed that lending was like a side business or a hobby, that if you were a large platform with millions of customers, you could do it on the side. I think people have realized that's no longer the case, right? Lending requires a certain type of DNA, certain kind of risk understanding. And either you build it as a real core skill set of the business and monetize it properly, or you just don't dabble in it, right? People can no longer say, hey, I'm a payments company or an insurance company or a wealth management company that's doing lending a little bit on the side. I don't think that model works. And I think the industry is learning that it doesn't work, right? You build it as a core muscle and do it. And I think just the third is in terms of innovation along, obviously there are different forms of credit. There's unsecured, there's secured. I think a large part of the last few years was around unsecured and continuing to be around unsecured, particularly in consumer credit, etc. But we are now starting to see some interesting innovations with fintechs also thinking about the secured space, right? Because that's typically a space that's always been held by the banks, whether it's home loans, auto loans, etc. I think given a lot of the digital public infrastructure over the last few years has been in consumer and in kind of unsecured, I think we're starting to see that now build from an infrastructure-wise, even in secured lending.
What's your reading of how regulations evolving in India? And there's a certain amount of tension between that and entrepreneurs who want to really innovate. What is work in progress? What can be better?
So it's a very interesting question. And I think I'll start by echoing Gaurav's point that to some extent, I think there is this false dichotomy in people's minds between regulation and innovation, right? Just as you would never give a loan without underwriting, you should never give a loan without doing KYC. So our business is to figure out how to deliver a great customer experience within the ambit of regulation, right? And we think that's quite binary. At the same time, I think there are two areas of tension that need to be resolved. The first is around kind of consumer and consumption lending. And the second is around cost of funds. Let me take each one by one, right? On consumption lending, there is a lot of kind of discussion in the industry that some of the recent moves may be directed towards slowing down consumer finance. Now, while that may be required in certain pockets that have been growing unsustainably, overall as a country, we need consumer lending, right? Consumption is a key driver of our economy, right? Even a business, if it receives credit, needs to have consumers to actually sell those products to. And the only way we grow at 8, 9% GDP growth and get to a trillion economy is if the financial sector grows at 25% plus. That needs to happen with an expansion in consumer credit, right? So at the end of the day, I think we as an economy need to get behind the idea that credit is an essential lubricant for consumption to grow, and consumption growth is going to be a key driver of GDP growing forward, right? And I think that is a mindset that is important. To some extent, in India, we have a little bit of a conflicted relationship with debt, right? On the one hand, we think it's not necessarily the best way to operate, but at the same time, we want growth as an economy. These two ideas are mutually inconsistent, right? Debt, to a certain degree, is essential for growth, right? And it needs to be managed as such. The second, I think, is around cost of funding, because the reality today is innovation in lending is coming from new entrants and challengers. new entrants and challengers fundamentally face a disadvantage around a high cost of funds. And that forces most people to operate in a largely unsecured space and at higher price points. If we want to break this dynamic, if we want more innovation in secured lending, if we want lower price points of unsecured lending, we need to find ways to open up the regulatory architecture to enable challengers to tap into a new cost of funds. That could be either through having more banks, or it could be through opening up the debt capital markets, like in Western economies, where you can actually securitize large portions of your loans and sell them down to investors at different tiers of capital. I think until we have wider and deeper debt capital markets, this will remain a constraint to innovation, and that action needs to come from a regulatory and policy side.
And what's the thinking on how this can be managed without it again sort of snowballing into another multiple repackagings of risk that sort of goes out of control?
See, at the end of the day, we have a very strong tenet within our company. You need growth metrics and you need accompanying guardrails. Nothing works without both these. So just as we need deeper capital markets, we need guardrails, right? So things like having seasoning, mandatory seasoning is important. Things like ensuring skin in the game, right? So actually originators retaining a portion of every loan are important, right? Things like having the right level of transparency around the underlying data of loans that are packaged is important. Now, the good news is the building blocks for all these things are already in place. We already have minimum holding period, MHP and MRR requirements. And now with Account Aggregator, you could actually create transparency around the underlying financial quality of loans, because you can actually have access to banking data, to GST data. So I think there is actually adequate data and infrastructure out there to create these guardrails to open up our capital markets more.
From a general audience's perspective, demystify Account Aggregator for us a bit. I think now folks understand UPI nicely.
Yeah. No, so it is in one way doing to credit and underwriting what UPI did to payments, right? Account Aggregator simply allows a customer to provide access to their bank statements or bank accounts in a very easy digital kind of transparent manner, right? So literally by click or two of the button, entering an OTP, right? When I am underwriting you for a loan, I need to understand obviously what is happening with your income, how you are earning. I need that insight into your banking transactions, banking history. Earlier, the way it would work is a customer would give a PDF file, somebody will kind of digitize that file, look at it, convert it to Excel, understand what's going on, and that would take hours, if not days. Now, if you're delivering a loan in a matter of minutes, the data also has to come in an ingestible format. And I think Account Aggregator is doing that, right? Today, within a matter of a few seconds, obviously with the consent of the customer, etc., giving you access to their bank account, you're able to say, hey, I know this is your income, this is your expenses. Here's your loan for, let's say, 50,000 to a lakh rupees. Please enjoy. And then let's, figure out how do we kind of grow this relationship with you.
Walk me through the consent process in a typical Axio loan.
A customer is shopping online. Right? They see our, offering that says, hey, your card value is, let's say, 20,000 rupees. You could either pay for this by debit card, credit card, UPI, etc. But guess what? If you don't have a credit card and you want to split this payment of 20,000 rupees into 6 months or 12-month installments, why don't you apply here for immediate credit, right? So they literally click the button. We obviously display all the terms and conditions of the loan. And within a matter of a few seconds, right, we are able to underwrite this customer and say, okay, Hari, you are approved for 20,000 rupees. Please continue your shopping. And guess what? You don't have to pay the entire 20,000 rupees now. You can pay 3,000 rupees per month over the next 6 to 7 months. And this is all happening while the customer is checking out. So essentially what we have built, and I think that is the strongest point in the company over the last few years, is the ability to understand a customer's credit worthiness in real time online, ability to approve a large number of people, right? Because you don't want to keep rejecting. It's not good for the merchants as well. And control the NPAs 3 months, 6 months later to sub 2%, right? This trifecta is really what is allowing us to power.
And underneath all of this is a non-negotiable layer of compliance, right? So in this seamless process that Gaurav just spoke about, we're taking consent from the customer upfront to access their bureau. We are actually accessing their bureau and reporting into the bureau later on, right? We are checking their PAN details with the NSDL. We are doing an Aadhaar-based eKYC, right? The underwriting is assessing not just intent, but intent, ability, disposable income, and identity. And post this transaction, there is also a key fact statement, a KFS sent to the customer, detailing out all the different terms and conditions of the loan. So we really believe that, you know, it is possible in India with a lot of the DPI that's come up in the last few years to deliver a real-time, delightful, seamless credit experience at the point of checkout while ensuring that compliance is met not just in letter but in spirit.
And what is more important, right, that most of this credit is at interest-free cost to the customer, right? Most of what we give to these customers is zero interest. The interest is borne by the merchant, right? Because they like to see a higher kind of uptake of orders. They like to see their customers purchase more. So customers are actually being able to buy and split it into installments without any additional interest cost. And on the back end, again, because of a lot of the infrastructure, we actually power and co-lend along with banks. So it's not just our capital, but we even got banks who are now powering our co-lending, right? And that's allowing us to scale. So one is the ability to underwrite in real time, but the second is the ability to scale. Obviously, we are limited by the size of our balance sheet, but banks have much larger balance sheets, right? How do we bring them and partner with them and actually grow the piece of the pie?
So going forward, what do you see as your biggest sort of broader opportunity? I mean,
so, you know, as we think about our business, there are essentially two areas of growth that we work on, right? The first is the use cases that we can finance. And the second is the products that we can offer customers once they use us. On the use cases that we finance, right, we started out primarily with e-commerce. Today, e-commerce remains the core of what we do, but we are also financing in sectors such as healthcare, in sectors such as insurance. We're starting to finance offline as well. And we believe very strongly that the right entry point for consumers for credit is end-use control, right? Where a customer is taking a loan for the first time for a specific purpose, and the credit is contextual and tailored to that purpose. We firmly believe in this. And so you talked about ONDC. ONDC presents a very interesting opportunity for embedded finance or embedded credit to become go into the long tail. Because ONDC essentially will digitize a large number of long tail merchants offline and allow service providers like us to plug into the workflows of these merchants. So just as today we're able to finance purchases on large e-commerce platforms for large brands, we hope that ONDC will create an opportunity for us to become a financing partner, not just for the large brands and the large platforms, but for the smaller merchants who meet our day-to-day needs as well, right? I think the second big area of opportunity for us is being able to serve our customer over multiple needs over their lifetime. Today, the relationship starts with checkout financing for a specific product. Over time, we also upsell these customers larger ticket personal loans, which they may require. These could be self-employed or for personal use. Ultimately, we want to be a one-stop shop for our customer. And we'd love at some point to figure out how to go beyond unsecured lending and potentially be able to offer our existing customers a secured loan as well, if the need for a two-wheeler, or a car or a home arises. And I think as we start to see more innovation in digital public infrastructure on the secured side, this will become an exciting growth vector for us.
And by one-stop shop, do you mean credit for every requirement, or do you also mean other products like insurance and going beyond?
I think firstly, the focus will always be on credit because that's what we've learned how to do, right? And I think one of the learnings for us over the last few years has been staying focused and not trying to diversify ourselves too much, right? That said, if we do offer other products, it may be in partnership with underwriters of insurance or may be in banks. We may not manufacture the product ourselves, but credit we will always manufacture ourselves because we probably have learned now how to actually do it the right way.
Tell us a bit more about Axio itself. From the time that you all started, We've grown into a much bigger office, several floors, in a prime area. How large is your team now? Give us a sense of some of the type of specialists you've had to recruit along the way.
Yeah, sure. So I think we are almost about 800 odd people in the organization right now, right? And this spans from engineers to product folks, finance, HR, but obviously a lot of it is also, you know, underwriting, collections, etc. Right. So I think what we've, again, done well is got a good blend of folks who come from financial services and a good blend of folks who come from technology and actually marry this kind of culture together, right? Because the folks who come from financial services, conservative, they know, they've seen cycles, they make sure you don't lose your shirt in the process. But the folks who come from the Googles and the better startups and the high growth startups are always pushing you towards innovation. So this creative tension between these two types of folks is really the culture that we've tried to develop, and we really like that, right? Because you have to keep moving forward, obviously within regulation, within kind of what a customer wants, but you can very quickly go wrong in lending, right? So the financial services folks who've seen it and been there and done that many times are always kind of making sure you're two steps forward, one step back. And I think that's the right design for us, at least as an organization that's operating in this fintech and lending world.
And one of the interesting outcomes of that design, now that we've been a company that's been operating for quite a few years, is we have folks that have, you know, been with us for several years. I mean, I think at a recent company meet, we kind of realized that over 60% of our managers have been with us for over 6 years. Is that we now have folks who may have started on one side of that equation, but over time have actually learned hybrid skill sets. So we have product managers today who think more about risk than a risk person. We have UX designers today who literally understand the text of a RBI circular or compliance requirement. And the magic really happens when this creative tension is not just something we try and role model, it's when it becomes embedded in the team. Because you have people who have lived through cycles, people who have seen the ups and downs in the industry, and have been able to, within themselves, combine the expertise that they came into the company with everything they have learned in the last few years.
Can you give us a glimpse into what you see today as the Axio culture?
I think one of the things that we have observed about ourselves in the last 2 to 3 years is we have, in many cases, been on the more conservative side of the fintech market, right? Whether it comes in down to growth rates, UX, focus on risk, etc. And at times, it has meant that we may have grown slower than some of our peers. We are okay with that. In fact, sometimes we are happy to grow slower. Right? And I think that is a learning that has come over a period of time. When Gaurav and I started the business, we had never done any lending. We actually didn't come from a banking background. We felt that was a strength because we could reimagine things from the ground up. But we also had to go through a very important period of learning and seeing cycles and seeing regulatory intervention at a macro level to develop a little bit of that conservatism that I think is very important when you're a lender. Right? Because the only thing that reveals what's working in lending is time. Right? No matter how much data you have, no matter how smart you are, you have to see how a product or a segment or a geography evolves over a period of time to really be able to say if your model is working or not. And so I think, you know, in a single word, the journey has made us more patient. And I think we're more attuned to playing the long game as a result of that. So when we plan, yes, we have quarterly planning, annual planning, etc. But I think we take a much longer horizon to set our goals than before.
I think the other thing is, we've spoken about this a few times today, is resilience, right? So one of our core values is like really living on the battlefield. And it's not just been demonstrated by us over the last few years, it's been demonstrated by a lot of our team members that when the good times are there, we don't get too carried away. But when the hard times come, we dig deep, we just stay focused for 3, 4 months, 6 months, however long it takes to kind of ride the cycle out, right? And that, I think, is probably the best thing about our culture, is because, as Shashank said, a lot of people have been there, they've seen the cycles with us, and now they just know how to manage it, and there's kind of a playbook for this resilience, right? And there will be many more cycles that we will face over the next 10 years, right? But today, it doesn't kind of get us worried as it did 5 years ago, because we know what we are capable of, and we know how to be resilient.
Will you need more funding? I mean, in the sense of VC funding or debt funding or whatever is sort of the norm in your business?
So, you know, Hari, money is the raw material for our business, right? So we will always be fundraising both on the equity and the debt side. But I think where we are today, the debt that we take on our balance sheet and our co-lending pipelines are a far more important driver of growth. And I think we've been fortunate over the years, to Gaurav's point on resilience, to build deep relationships with partners, right? Banks, NBFCs, other financial institutions, on the debt side and on the co-lending side. And so these are really the twin engines of scaling up for us. And of course, we will continue to raise equity at regular intervals along the way.
Okay. Last few questions on your own sort of personal growth. You mentioned earlier, you're both Stanford MBAs, you come from different backgrounds. And if I recall right, in your case, your parents are well-known academics. You come from a business family. Can you give me a sort of a sense of what are some of the things you both had to learn as well as unlearn as you became sort of from young startup founders to a more, as you said, a conservative lending business?
You know, one of the things we had to unlearn was honestly kind of this desire that every startup founder has to do 10 things in the first 3 years, right? We started off with SME loans, consumer loans, taxi loans. Like within the first 3 years, we were doing like some 15 loan products, right? Because honestly, at times you think you're a young startup, you've just raised money, you're invincible, you can conquer the world, you can be the next Bajaj Finance, right? Bajaj Finance took 3 decades and kudos to them. They built a great business. I think time and patience kind of is something that we had to learn and unlearn, right? And so learning this, getting rid of FOMO became a very important learning for us, right? How do we just stay focused and just forget about what everyone is doing? It's very easy to say, but when every new startup comes up every 6 months, raises a boatload of cash, becomes a unicorn in your space, you want to go and jump and do that new fancy product. I think over the last 3 years, we've restrained ourselves. And I think it wasn't easy, but looking back, I think that is one of the things that we've had to learn and unlearn is just forget about what everyone around you is doing, mature up and grow up a little bit, and just have this fear of, don't have this fear of kind of missing out.
You know, one thing I think for me personally, but I think for all of us as a team, has been around, you know, getting our hands dirty and getting granular. A lot of what you learn around business in business school is around how to be a CEO of a large company. As a former consultant, I spent a lot of time on the advisory side, but I would move on to a different project, a different client in a few months. This business of financial services, fintech, lending, is all about the details. And I think one of the learnings for me has been developing a love for being in the weeds, getting super granular, whether it's looking at, you know, day-to-day data around funnel conversion, digging into collections, flow rates, reading the text of every circular to exactly understand what the regulation wants. This business literally lives in the details. And I think for us as well, one of the kind of growing up periods in this business has been rather than ascending to a level of kind of delegation and stepping back, it's actually been about, you know, embracing the details, rolling up our sleeves, kind of being very hands-on while obviously empowering the team and ensuring that at no point in time do we lose sight of the little things which make up this business.
In your own sort of personal growth, I know that in running Axio, you probably don't have a whole lot of time to reflect on these kinds of things. But still in your quiet moments, when you think about who am I, where am I at today as a person, as a human being, and when you walk into work as a corporate leader and so on, does anything stand out to you in terms of how you all have changed versus 10 years ago?
You know, I think we have grown as much, the business has grown in the last kind of 10 years, particularly in the last 3-4 years, right? I'll just talk about my example, right? I've been able to find something outside work, which has been my fitness journey, my triathlons, doing Ironman events, right? That has kept me more energized and excited about walking into work as a leader, right? Because I think the battles that you face at work, sometimes you question as to, do you have the mental grit to be able to take this on and do it for another 5 years, 10 years? But when you outside of work find that passion and do something as hard as finishing an Ironman, right? You know that you have that capability. Now, obviously, this is a separate field. But you've built that inner confidence that, okay, if you can run a race for 12 and a half hours, you can definitely come in the work next day. And no matter what work or life kind of throws at you, you'll have the ability to deal with it, right? I think that is a learning that at least has really impacted me and changed me over the last few years for the better.
You know, what I found in the first few years was I was very reactive. That you hear about a competitor raising funding and you say, oh, you know, we need to catch up. You hear about someone growing 2x faster than you and one feels FOMO. You hear about businesses, the same business in a different geography, kind of going into a new sector and you feel, oh, maybe we should do the same. And so I found that in many ways, this kind of race that we all end up in, at least in the beginning, can make one kind of lose sight of the bigger picture. And for me, finding a way to be centered has actually come down to two very different things, right? So the first is perspective. And this is where I think history has been a very interesting teacher for me. I have a huge passion for history. I read a lot, I listen to a lot in mostly the commute time that I have. And I think the one thing you learn from history is, you know, when you zoom out, successes look very ephemeral. It's actually staying power that has determined who actually made a mark or who didn't, right? And so I think just creating that ability to zoom out in our own business has been important to me. And, you know, also internalizing this idea that it's about showing up at the wicket and batting. It's about staying on the battlefield to the core value Gaurav spoke about and just being at it. And especially in a country like India, which is always growing, always exciting, but does have short-term disruptions, batting at the wicket and not getting out, I think, is the key to long-term success. The second thing is, for me, is being trying to just enjoy the day-to-day without also overthinking the so what of things. And there, the biggest kind of learning experience for me has actually been a dad, right? Over the last 2 years, I've had two beautiful children. And one of the best ways for me to kind of gain some perspective after a long day of work is just spending time with them. Because children live in the present. They're super in the moment. And sometimes that's what you need as a business, right? Not to worry about the sound and noise around you, but just actually enjoy that meeting, that day's victory, a good interaction with the team, things like that.
Wonderful conversation. But I know I have to let you go. Anything that you all want to add in the small context of this conversation?
I just feel we are still the stepping stone of what we can achieve over the next 3 to 5 years, right? I think having 9, 10 million customers is good, right? But if I just play this out over the next 3, 4 years, having 25, 30, 40 million customers, for most of who we are the first point of credit, I think that is what keeps us excited and that is what also keeps us awake at night. But that's what we've learned to enjoy.
You know, I was reflecting on what you said when we started this conversation, that the first time we met was about 6 or 7 years ago. And it made me realize that, you know, one of the things that we've come to appreciate is just relationships, right? And at the end of the day, we talk a lot about loans and, you know, giving money in seconds and building a lot of cool tech. But financial services is about relationships, right? If you build good relationships with your customer, that is the biggest driver of risk, really, at the end of the day, right? People who you have been good to pay you back. If you build relationships with your employees, the organization is better set up to weather cycles. If you have long relationships with your bankers, you will be able to weather dislocations in the capital markets. And so, you know, we spend an inordinate amount of time, I think, in this business talking about the harder things like tech and data science and machine learning and AI. But I think just vintage, time, and having a higher share of your important relationships be multi-year rather than transactional, I think that's probably been one of the most rewarding parts of the journey and also I think a key ingredient for success in the long term. So I hope that this is not just the third of our many conversations, but the third out of many more to come.